talk about this all night, but we have to get learning. Let's go. Okay, let's learn the Rav's book instead of the Rav's life. Okay, so we are holding on page 52 in my version.
34 in mine. Bottom of 34. Prayer likewise.
That's right. Okay, so we're speaking about the three ways in which prophecy and prayer complement each other. The three ways how prophecy and prayer are the elements of the covenantal community. And as the Rav is saying, that prayer did not replace prophecy, but continued it. That's what we're speaking about over here. Because the ikkar, the main point of both prayer and prophecy, is not the words being said, but the confrontation. The main point of both prayer and prophecy is not the dialogue, as much as the existential dialogue, the meeting of the two parties in the covenantal community. And therefore the Rav says that prayer replaced prophecy, prayer continued prophecy. So he said that there are three things in which prayer and prophecy are similar, and we're in the middle of the first one. Let's read again from the beginning where it says number one, read quickly, we did this paragraph, but there's a footnote we didn't do yet, and let's just, to get us back to be able to understand when he gets into prayer. So everyone, we're up to number one, yeah? In both communities, meaning between prayer and prophecy, a confrontation of God and man takes place. Meaning, again, the experience of each other. It is quite obvious that the prophecy awareness, which is in character totally different from the mystical experience, because as we said, what's the difference between a mystical experience and prophecy? Mystical experience is experiencing something of God, but not confrontation with God, whereas prophecy is confronting God. So that prophecy awareness can only be interpreted in the unique categories of the covenantal event. Meaning prophecy, by definition, is a covenant. It's a relationship. A mystical experience is not a relationship. Everyone understands also the difference between, we would say, a romantic fling and a relationship. A romantic fling, what's the word they use?
Encounter.
No, the romantic fling, they use with a P, no?
Tryst.
A tryst, okay. Romantic fling is not the same thing as having a relationship, right? It's just, so to speak, experiencing the other person, not having a relationship with the other person, right? And so a mystical experience is a romantic experience of God, but it's not a relationship. Prophecy is a relationship. The whole idea of prophecy would be fraught with an inner contradiction if man's approach to God remained indirect and impersonal, expecting nature to mediate between him and his creator. Only within the covenantal community, which is formed, which we said, which is begun by God descending upon the mount, and then man upon the call of the Lord ascending the mount, which is this week's parsha, the end of this week's parsha, when Moshe is told to send up to Hashem, is a direct and personal relationship expressing itself in the prophetic face-to-face colloquy established. Only then could there be the face-to-face relationship and the face-to-face relationship established. And the Lord spoke unto Moshe face-to-face as man speaks unto his friend. So the Rav is saying that what's prophecy? Speaking face-to-face with God. That Moses spoke to face-to-face with God. That's how the relationship began. Yeah? Look at the footnote. What?
Is the Rav going to at all explain what prophecy is?
More than what he said now? No. Yeah. He's saying that prophecy is the beginning of a covenantal relationship, where God speaks to man, where you're not having a romantic fling, you're experiencing the divine, you're actually having a relationship with God that God is speaking to you and encountering you. Yeah? What's the problem?
No, I still don't understand what prophecy is.
As opposed to everything, having the existential encounter where God is speaking to you, we're having a relationship?
No, having a relationship. The Rav is saying that prayer is an extension of prophecy.
Correct.
And he's saying that Moshe Rabbeinu is the paradigm of prophecy.
Right.
He speaks face to face with God.
Right.
What about everybody else, aside from Moshe?
That's the footnote.
Okay.
That's exactly the footnote. I was waiting. Good. Okay. Let's see the footnote. That's why I did this paragraph again, because we didn't do the footnote. Look at the footnote on page 53 on the bottom. This verse, again, because the Rav is establishing speaking God face to face, but that it says about Moshe. So, but the Rav says, the Jay's question, this verse telling us about the prophetic encounter of Moses with God describes the ideal state of prophecy as it was attained by Moses. The Bible itself, in another passage, meaning the end of Baalei Yischa, contrasts the Mosaic confrontation with God with that of other prophets who failed to reach the same heights. What do you mean the same heights? Face to face, like friends talking, right? And hence experienced the numinous apocalyptic dread and awe. Numinous is the word from Rudolf Otto in the idea of the holy. Numinous is like, where it's like the glow of the supernatural. That's what numinous means. So the other prophets experienced this numinous apocalyptic dread and awe, meaning that the other prophets also didn't attain prophecy in its pristine state. We know there are 13 principles of faith. Sometimes we forget to remember that, you know, we believe in the unity of God. We believe that you can only pray to God. We believe that Moses' prophecy is different than all of the prophets. That's one of the 13 principles of faith, which makes it so important. Well, anyone wonder why that is? Brother, why is it one of the 13 principles of faith right up there that you can only pray to God and there's only one God and that the Torah won't change? You have to believe that Moses' prophecy was different than all the other prophets.
He was the messenger of halacha.
Exactly, right.
He was the giver of halacha.
That's correct. Because that's halacha only comes from Moses. All the other prophets could never change the law. In other words, the whole legitimacy of halacha, of Jewish law, which fits with what we were talking about before, about Rav Soloveitchik, right? That you could change one's hashkafa, but you can't change halacha, right? Because halacha, we believe, was the greatest revelation that Moses had face to face that only he could give of the law.
Except two things. One is we do change the halacha when the time presents itself to change it, which we have, evidently have done in past history, haven't we?
So we don't change halacha. We apply halacha differently. Mm-hmm. And that's not just semantics.
That's not what the Torah says.
Why?
You can
rendezvous. I'm sorry. My mind works. Rendezvous. That was the word I was looking for romantic fling. Sorry. I thought it wasn't P. It's an R. Sorry.
Silent P.
It's no P. I don't know why I thought it was a P.
We know Talmidei Chachamim can oker davar min haTorah.
Come on, Jay. That's a whole sug in Yevamos.
Right.
When could there be Oikadav Minatora?
Forget about the entire sugya until you come to the Maskana. The Gemara says you can be Oker Dava Minatora.
But only B'Shev Al Tase. And only if that's in order to further establish the halacha itself. You can't throw slogans. That's what Mishachistim do, by the way. You can't throw slogans,
don't
right?
Don't we also have it that God
the whole, once again, the sugya that says, when are Chacham able to be Oikim in a Torah? When could they apply their jurisdiction? Mm-hmm. If it's in order to strengthen the keeping of halacha, then they can never tell you to go against the halacha, to do something against the halacha. They can tell you, don't do the halacha A, because halacha B needs strengthening. In order to strengthen the keeping of Shabbos, they could tell you, don't blow shofar, don't pick up a lulav, don't read the Megillah. Well, that itself is Darabana. But they could tell you not to blow shofar and pick up a lulav, because they want to strengthen the halacha of Shabbos. I want to strengthen, they have the power to strengthen halacha B, and therefore I'm going to say, don't do halacha A. So again, it's coming from the koyach of strengthening halacha. What do you want to say, Lenny?
The other thing is, don't we have, the fact that God gave the Torah to people, and thus, once He gave it to us, it's no longer His jurisdiction, it's ours. It's an our power.
So that's the pilpul that Jonathan spoke earlier, where the conservative rabbis want to use that Lerba Shemayim to say, so now we could also drive on Shabbos, because that way we'll get people to come to shul. So that becomes, in other words, again, when the Gemara says over there, Lerba Shemayim in Bab Metzia, that it's not in heaven's jurisdiction, that means that it's now up to us to apply the rules of halacha according to those rules, to come to decisions based on those rules of halacha, not subjective convenience. That's the difference. In other words, like this, here's the thing. The best example, I don't want to get too much into this because I don't want to get into the way halacha works, because we have to get back to the Rav, but it's a very important idea. It's in Hashkafa. A Supreme Court can never rule against the Constitution. Correct?
Correct.
What could the Supreme Court and judges do?
Reinterpret,
reapply. But they can't go against the Beferish Constitution. They could say that according to the rules of the Constitution, now X, Y, and Z will apply. Mm-hmm. Right? But they can't say, and Kilo, if there would be a Baskol with Thomas Jefferson, would come and say, you, Supreme Court, are wrong. The Supreme Court would then be able to say, like the Gemara B'Metzia, that this, they could say, we don't listen to you, Thomas Jefferson, anymore, because based on the rules that you wrote in the Constitution, now those rules of the Constitution will say that this is the law today. But they can't uproot a halacha of the Constitution completely, right? So anyway, it's a big issue. But the Indian is, but Moshe Rabbeinu's prophecy, the reason that it's so important is to understand, because he is the source of he is the one that wrote the Constitution, and therefore we have to believe that that came from God. But what does it have to, yeah?
Getting back to
So what does it have to do with what we're saying? The Rav is saying...
I have a question. Yeah. It seems to be that the only Moshe, putting aside Moshe, all prophetic interaction with God is God talking to you, and all prayer is you talking to God.
Right.
And there's no mixing of the two. There's never, except for Moshe.
Well,
Moshe is the only time that there's an intercourse of conversation.
No, that's not true. There are other prophets that had dialogues with God. Isaiah, Yonah, Shia, Yirmiyah, they all spoke to God. No. But the point that they all spoke back and forth. The point that the Rav is saying, though, is that the apex of achievement of prophecy was only done by Moses. So what's important to understand is that the difference between Moses and other prophets was only quantitative and not qualitative. That's what the Rav wants to say. That quantitatively, Moses' clearness of his face-to-face was the greatest. But qualitatively, all the prophets had the same type of dialogue of God speaking to them. Prayer is then us continuing that. Now we continue that. Now let's see prayer. This is what we're up to. Okay? Prayer likewise is... Now I want to just tell you, the next... page into is we have to really, this is very important, we have to really focus on this, okay? Prayer likewise is unimaginable without having man stand before and address himself to God in a manner reminiscent of the prophet's dialogue with God. That sentence has to be read again. Prayer likewise is unimaginable without having man stand before and address himself to God in a manner reminiscent of the prophet's dialogue with God. So the first thing that we have to know that the Rav is saying is that prayer is unimaginable as just being saying words. Right? Because just like we said about prophecy, the point of prophecy is not that God said words, that God sent messages and, you know, sent text SMSs or texts to the prophets. He didn't send texts. God never used WhatsApp. You ever see that meme? I have of a guy standing on a mountaintop and saying, God, give me an answer that my prayers have been answered. And then like two blue checks like come out from heaven. You never saw that? So that's not what prophecy is. God doesn't send texts, right? It's a dialogue. So the Rav is saying that prayer likewise is unimaginable without having man stand before and address himself to God. You're standing before God.
Isn't that by definition?
What?
I mean, isn't that by common definition?
That what? That prayer is
standing before God and talking to God.
It depends how what you mean by common.
Meaning,
in other words, everyone.
This is good. If you would have asked me that,
you would have said that prayer is dalifnei miata omed, knowing you stand before God. Right. So here's the thing. There's a rule from Mesilas Yesharim. You have Mesilas Yesharim from the Ramchal. The very first thing he says in the introduction is one of the most fundamental things we always have to remember. The Ramchal writes in the introduction to Mesilas Yesharim a very important rule. The more famous an idea is, the more it's forgotten. The more famous and prevalent an idea is, the more it tends to be overlooked. Those aspects of Judaism that Baal Tshuvas are taught before they're even observant are the most important ones that often Orthodox people forget about. And there are a lot of examples for this, but let's just stick with this one right now. Okay. Prayer is standing before God. Most people won't say that. In fact, the Rav is going to elaborate in a second when he's going to say something that, if I were to say to you, let's say it outside first. If I were to say to you, anyone know the 18 brachas of Shemoneh Esrei, the 18 blessings of Shemoneh Esrei, what's their structure?
Praise.
Requests. And thanks, right? Everyone knows the first three blessings of the Shemoneh Esrei is praise. The next 12 are requests, and the final three are thanksgiving, right? So most people would tell you, what's prayer? What's prayer? Praising God, requesting from God, and thanking God. Is that true, Ellie? Would you have said that that's what prayer is? Praising God, thanking God, and requesting from God?
One aspect of it.
It's the mechanics of it.
Oh. So most people would tell you, what do you mean? I learned in yeshiva that Shemoneh Esrei is praise, thanksgiving, and asking for things. So exactly the word Len uses what the Rav's about to say. Because we're so used to praying or whatever, or davening, whatever it is that we do most days, we forget that even if you know the lumdus and the structure of tefillah and all the halachas and all of the different pilpulim of what tefillah is supposed to be and when you're supposed to say yalav yavo, what happens if you forget yalav yavo, and when, you know, what you're supposed to add on musaf and to turn the pages, and you're supposed to add this paragraph of Yom Tov and Shabbos and everything. There's a friend of mine told me that he was once in a shul, it was actually in 770, and there was an old Russian guy that got up, and you know how on the musaf on Yom Tov, so there's like B'yom HaSheni, B'yom HaShlishi, you have to know every day of Sukkot which one you're supposed to add.
Yeah.
He pushed it, read the whole thing. He was an old guy, he never learned you, B'yom HaSheni, B'yom HaShlishi, B'yom Ravi, Min Chosim, he just kept reading every paragraph. Because he didn't have an art scroll. Yeah. And I'm sure there were a lot of Jews in Europe that daven like that, right? There are a lot of Jews in Europe that daven like that. They didn't have the art scroll to say, you know, on the sixth day of Sukkot or whatever. So we get so used to these constructs of prayer, thanksgiving, and request, and what to say when, that we forget, like Lenny said, that those are the mechanics of prayer. And like the Messias and Shram says, we tend to forget the most important part of prayer, which is standing before God. And I challenge you, three times a day when you daven, every time you ever open your, before you open your mouth, think about that. As simple as that might sound, I challenge you every time you stand up to daven, before you open your mouth, think about this sentence. That it's unimaginable without having man stand before and address himself to God in a manner reminiscent of the prophet's dialogue with God, that I'm actually standing before God. Let's read a little further. The cosmic drama, notwithstanding its grandeur and splendor, no matter how distinctly it reflects the image of the Creator, and no matter how beautifully it tells his glory, cannot provoke man to prayer. Now that, when I read that, that's a chiddush. That means you're seeing a beautiful sunset, a beautiful scene on the shore in Mexico, right? And that beautiful cosmic splendor cannot provoke man to prayer.
Cannot or should not?
Cannot. Now, does that make sense?
No.
You're saying it doesn't, right? Why are you saying it doesn't? Seemingly, what do you mean? When you see a beautiful nature scene, what could provoke you to prayer more than that?
Or
a new baby. But the Rav is saying no. Well, a cosmic... That's why I want to show you. This is a chiddush, what the Rav is saying. Listen carefully.
Okay.
You're seeing what he's saying?
Yes,
the cosmic... This is a chiddush. Mm-hmm. The cosmic drama, notwithstanding its grandeur and splendor, of a baby being born, a beautiful sunset, cannot, no matter how distinctly it reflects the image of the Creator, no matter how beautifully it tells His glory, cannot provoke man to prayer.
Prayer. His definition of prayer.
Oh, because what's why? Of course it may arouse an adoring, ecstatic mood in man.
Mm-hmm.
It may even inspire man to raise his voice in a song of praise and thanksgiving. But nevertheless, ecstatic adoration, even if expressed in a hymn, is not prayer. Why not? Why is ecstatic adoration expressed in a beautiful song not prayer?
It's not dialectic.
It's not dialectic. It's not dialogue. You know, what are love songs all about? Think for a second. Love songs, the most beautiful love songs in love poetry, are always about the beloved. Think for a second. Love songs and poetry are about the beloved. But what happens when you're actually standing face to face with your beloved? Then there's silence. Then you don't say poetry and sing songs. It's a creed. What the Rav is saying is so deep. Beautiful nature experience could provoke you to have ecstasy and adoration of God, but not necessarily talk to God. Correct. That's why Pesuk de Zimra is not called Tefillah. Tefillah Baruch Atah Hashem. That's exactly the case. Pesuk de Zimra is singing love songs about God, but not yet having a dialogue with God.
So I understand what the Rav is saying in this paragraph is what he said in the previous one, and it's a mystical experience.
Exactly. Yes.
However, taking it a step further to what he says, that prayer must be a dialogue, a dialogue must be two-sided. And I still don't understand how you can... remaining in silence when you face God is still not a dialogue.
I thought
that's what we spoke about last week, that it is. You didn't see the quote from Mother Teresa
The Mother Teresa thing was fantastic.
Wasn't that great? Do you remember? Did you see it?
Yes, 100%. But it's still not...
What?
It's still not a dialogue.
Let me just say it over quickly in case anyone didn't see it, where this student of mine sent me, based on last week's class, that an interviewer asked Mother Teresa, what was the Lashon exactly?
What does she say when she prays to God?
What do you say when you pray to God? So she says, I don't say anything, I just listen. Mm-hmm. So the interviewer misunderstood her and said, you just listen. And what does God say to you while you're praying? So she said, no, you misunderstood. He doesn't say anything either. He also just listens. It's just a listening of self to self. That's why in a real relationship, when it's not a romantic rendezvous or a fling, it's complete silence. There's no need for words. Right? What? Why are you bothered?
It's still not a dialogue.
So we spoke about that last week. It depends what you use when the word dialogue.
It's a nonverbal dialogue.
It depends what you mean with the word dialogue. It's not a dialogue as in like people talking, but it's an existential dialogue. It's what Buber called I and thou. It's communicating.
Presence.
Yeah. Nice. It's not the word dialogue is bothering you. So it's not don't call it a dialogue. Call it encounter. Call it confrontation. You know, there's a beautiful idea. When I saw this from the Rav, it reminded me one of the most, I don't know what adjective to use, so you'll figure it out on your own, that the Baal Shem Tov, you know, Baal Shem Tov has a lot of revolutionary, I don't want to say the word, you know, erratic, but that's the words that are used a lot of times in Kabbalah and Hasidism. So the Baal Shem Tov said that the ultimate level of Shmona Esrei is when a person can no longer move. You know, a lot of people like to shuckle a lot, like to go back and forth. So the Baal Shem Tov said, this is an exact quote from Tzavasa Rivash, which is a sefer for the Baal Shem Tov. Tzavasa Rivash, which is, you know, one-liners and statements from the Baal Shem Tov. Baal Shem Tov says, just like in coupling, in physical intimacy, in the beginning is movement, but when reaches a climax, one cannot move. Once it's this stillness and non-moving, so too in prayer, when one reaches ultimate connection with God, one can't move. And the moving, so to speak, is arousing oneself, but when one comes to such a confrontation with God, there's no movement. There's not even speech. And that's what the Rebbe is saying, because singing to your beloved still shows that there's a distance. The words of the Ebenezer uses, because of course in medieval Spain was the golden age of poetry, the Ebenezer said, Derech ha-mishoyer l'shtoikek. The way of the one that sings is to desire. When you desire, you sing. You sing to something that you desire. When you reach what you desire, you don't need to sing and you're silent. So the Rebbe is saying that seeing the beautiful nature scenes may arouse a dawning ecstatic mood, and it may even inspire man to raise his voice in a song of praise and thanksgiving. Nevertheless, that's not yet true unification with God. Nevertheless, ecstatic adoration, even if expressed in a hymn, is not prayer. Prayer, the latter prayer, transcends the bounds of liturgical worship, meaning what you have to say in one, we're turning the page, right? Which page, which paragraph? Prayer transcends the bounds of liturgical worship and must not be reduced to its external technical aspects, such as praise, thanksgiving, or even petition, which we know are the three parts of Shmoneh Esrei. The Rav says, no, you can't reduce it to its external technical aspects, such as praise, thanksgiving, or even petition. Don't reduce it to that. It transcends those boundaries. There's a famous story I'll just say over now, since I brought it up, and it's going to be relevant to what we're going to learn further, but I can't hold myself back from saying a good fleishik, a chesidah shemaisa. You know, this is a real fleishig maisa. That one time, the Rebbe Reb Zusha and the Naim Alimach, the Rebbe Lemech Lezhensk were the holy brothers, or Lemech Lezhensk and Reb Zusha, so they were the holy brothers that were in exile for many years. They would go around and hiding themselves, not telling people who they were, and there are many stories of their different travels. So to speak, the Gulliver travels of Hasidism, yeah? So one time, the Rebbe Melech and Reb Zusha, they found themselves in the middle of nowhere, in Ekvelt, Mamish, in the middle of nowhere. There were no Jews, there was nothing, no Jewish community, and they didn't have the kosher ways back then, so the kosher GPS. So finally, they found one. You know what that is? Do you Google it? Kosher GPS. It's very cool. Anyway, always where the minion kosher restaurants. Not now. Not later. So anyway, so the Rebbe Bzush and Rebbe Melech, they ended up in the middle of nowhere, and they come to this house where there's a Jew living there, and he's a simple Jew. Now, you know, today in today's day and age, Nebuch, there are kids in yeshivas that can't figure out how to learn a Gemara, and we make them feel like dirt. Where they know Mishnayos, they know Chumash. 100 years ago, a vast, big percentage of Jews didn't know how to read Chumash, Pashut. They didn't know anything. And today we make people feel inadequate if they don't know how to learn a Blad Gemara, which is crazy. Anyway, so Tavya, there were simple Jews that Mamish didn't know anything, nothing. So they came to the simple Jew, who Mamish, he didn't have anything in his house. All he had, and they asked if they could stay with him for a couple of days, or Shabbos, and they stayed with him, and they saw that all he had in his house is he got from his father a siddur. A sitter. But again, back in those days, they didn't have art school sitters with the instructions. It was a sitter. And they saw that every day, it would take him 6-7 hours to daven. Now they saw that he was a simple person, and every time he davened, 3 times a day, it would take him to daven. And they didn't understand, what's he doing? Until they saw. And they saw that, what did he do? He began the day, Moida Ani, and he pashut started reading all the words, Shachris, Mincha, Marv, you know, to like, you know, benching, rebenching, whatever, Tfilas Derech, Mincha, and then like, by Mincha, he would start picking up from the Shalosh Regalim, and he would start reading all the Shalosh Regalim, and then by Marv, he would finish the Siddur, Roshani Yom Kippur Shmoneh Esrei. He pashut read through the entire book every day, because his father said, you have to, 3 times a day, you have to daven, and he didn't know the order, so he would just read through the entire book the whole day. So the Rebbe Melech and Reb Zusha, they did him a big favor, and they took little pieces of paper, and they started writing instructions, that this is what you have to say in the morning, and this is what you have to say in the afternoon, and this is what you have to say on Pesach, and this paragraph. They put little pieces of paper in the sitter. So after a couple of days, they leave, and as they're leaving, they come to a river, and the Rebbe Bezusha takes out his handkerchief, and he, you know, waves it back and forth, and the river parts, and they walk across the river. Right? And then he waves his handkerchief again, and the river continues flowing. And as they're walking, apparently this Jew, the simple Jew, he dropped his sitter, and all the pieces of paper fell out. All the paper fell out, and he didn't know all the pages fell out. So he started running after Rebbe Zusha, Rebbe Melech, and he comes to the river, and he takes out his handkerchief, and he waves it, and the river parts, and he walks across it, and he runs to Rebbe Melech and Rebbe Zusha. And the Rebbe Melech and Rebbe Zusha look at him,
yeah,
and they're like shocked. This guy doesn't know anything, and whatever. And he said, "How do you do that?" He says, "What do you mean? I ask Hashem to. I need to get across the river. I wave my handkerchief and I get across the river. But you have to help me, Rebbe. You have to help me. The pieces of paper fell out." So they say to him, "You know what? Never mind. Just keep doing what you've been doing. If that's what's happening, just keep reading what you're reading." Don't worry about the pieces of paper. Just keep up your relationship with God the way it is, right? So that's the truth. That hundreds of years ago, our ancestors didn't know what to say here, but the details, but they had that relationship that the Rav is speaking about. And the Rav is saying, as big as we could be, grace the knockers, that we know that there's Shevach and Bakasha, that there's petition, thanksgiving, and praise. That's not prayer. Prayer is engagement, is that dialogue with God, is that confrontation with Hashem.
They had a better dialogue.
Yeah, that's right. That's right. My wife actually said once, there's an essayist called Anne Lamott. Ever heard of her? Anne Lamott. She wrote a lot of books, Anne Lamott. So she has a book about prayer where she says that essentially all of prayer, I think it might even be the name of the book, is help, wow, thanks. Help, wow, thanks. That's what all of prayer is, which is what the Rav is saying, right? Shevach, help, wow, thanks. Wow, thanks, help. So my wife said, but Judaism would add that there's a deeper type of prayer. Hi. Hi. Without a help, which without high? A well, without a thanks. Huh? Which hi?
Well, I'm totally sure.
Maybe the two highs are interconnected.
I need no conviction. V'chulei
v'ein kan mokam laharich. Fine, let's read further. Prayer is basically an awareness. Again, that's what the Rebbe is saying. So none of the external technical aspects, that's not prayer itself, no matter how beautiful the sunset. Because prayer is basically an awareness of man finding himself in the presence of and addressing himself to his maker. That's what prayer is. Finding himself in the presence of and addressing himself to his maker. And to pray has one connotation only, to stand before God. And now in the footnote, the Rav says something incredible. Look at this footnote over here. Let me just say it outside for a second. Anyone ever notice what makes the 18 blessings of the Shemoneh Esrei different than all the other blessings we ever say? Which words are absent from the blessings of the Shemoneh Esrei? Well, Asher Kedushanu is only in Birchas HaMitzvahs. When you eat an apple, you don't say Asher Kedushanu. What? That's a shiloh. But I'm saying from any other bracha, there's okay, all other brachas. Melech Ha'ilam. Melech Ha'ilam. You won't find in Shemoneh Esrei Melech Ha'ilam, king of the world. It's a fascinating thing.
He's supposed to stay close all the
time. What?
The closeness.
Exactly. That's what so Chassidus actually says, and in Chassidus this question is asked, and Chassidus says, because prayer is about ascending up to God, going out of the world, and other blessings are about bringing God into the world. That's what Chassidus says. But the Rav says, based on his philosophy, he says a deep thing. Look what he says in the footnote. The fact that we commence the recital of the Shemoneh Esrei by addressing ourselves to the God of Abram, Isaac, and Jacob, that's how we begin, is indicative of the covenantal relationship which, in the opinion of our sages, lies at the very root of prayer. In other words, how do we begin Shemoneh Esrei? God of Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. That's where we began the covenantal community. And the fact that prayer is founded upon the covenantal relationship is responsible for the omission of Malchus from the entire Shemoneh Esrei. That's incredible. So the Rav says, you know why you don't mention God as being king of the world? Because it's meaningless right now. It's meaningless right now. You know the most romantic feeling you could have with your beloved, which is in all the poetry and the songs, it's you and me against the world, right? In all the songs, will you lie here with me and forget about the world? That's the most romantic and intense version of what love is. We don't need the rest of the world, right? And how much that works. I mean, it's romantic and stuff, but it's not exactly practical when you have to pay the plumbing and stuff. But that's the thing. Forget about the world. It's just me and you. We forget about the world. And that's what Shemoneh Esrei is. There's no Melech Ha'olam. It's me standing before God. There is no world. I don't know if I ever told you. I think I might have. I don't remember what my story. One of the things that really affected the way I daven was an incident that happened when I was in Zichron Moshe. Did I ever tell you about it? I don't remember. You know what Zichron Moshe is? Chaim. And then you don't know Zichron Moshe. So you all know what a minion factory is, right?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Okay. So Zichron Moshe is like any disparaging thing you could say about a minion factory, multiply by 10, and that's Zichron Moshe. Zichron Moshe is in the heart of Geula, and there's literally like every 1 minute another minion starting, and there are people davening Shachas Mincha Marv at the same time. You have people davening Shachas and some Mincha, some Marv at the same time. They say Reb Beryl Soloveitchik Zatzal, the Brisker of Son, he used to say, I don't know what happens when you go into Zichron Moshe, but you're Yotze Tefillah. He says, I'm not sure what goes on there, like what actually happens, but you're Yotze. Right? So if you're never there, I just recommend in your next trip to Israel, as an experience, go to Zichron Moshe. Check it out. Just don't use the towels there. They have outside the bathroom on the roll, you know that Israeli thing? Where like whatever.
They were donated in 67.
Right, exactly. And they haven't been changed. And people go there, and you know, and when people, I never chup when people go out of the bathroom and they right away use the same washing cup that everyone else uses without washing their hands with soap. And that's how they wash whatever. I don't want to get into it. I don't gross anyone out. But anyway.
Right.
Sorry. So Zichron Moshe. So I was there once in Zichron Moshe, and I was doing that thing that you do in Zichron Moshe. The Reb Beryl said that you yotzei daven. I had just gone shopping. There's a great sfarim store across the street called Girsa. It's a very good sfarim store. Yossi, who's in a British Ger Chassid, is a good guy. I could tell him I sent you. Anyway, so I had just gone to Girsa. I'd gone shopping, and I had two bags full of sfarim. Now, one of the things about Jerusalem, those parts of Jerusalem, and I'll say this in a very sensitive way, is that although people there all dress ultra-Orthodox, how shall I say this? You can't always leave your wallet out in the open, if you know what I mean. Mm-hmm. Etc. Right. So I was a little scared because of this whole scene that was going on around me, and I had two books of Svarim, and seemingly you wouldn't imagine anyone steal a, you know, books, boxes, bags of Svarim, whatever. So my grandfather, by the way, my grandfather, Zecheinu Levracha, my grandfather, blessed memory, was in by the Hungarian labor camp during the war. He wasn't by the Nazis, he was in Muketaba, which was the Hungarian labor camp, which wasn't Club Med, but it wasn't as bad as the concentration camp. So he was able, for all the years that he was there, to keep his tefillin with him. I mean, they slept in very difficult conditions, but he was able to keep his tefillin with him the whole war, for all the years. And he used it, and other people used it. And when the war was over, when he was getting on a train to go back to Czechoslovakia, so there was a bunch of Jews on a train, and he wanted them to hoist him up. The train was about to leave, and he wanted them to hoist him a train. So he gave to one of the Jews to hold on to these tefillin, and then to help him up on the train. And the Jew took the tefillin and didn't let him get on the train. And he lost that tefillin that was with him the whole war. Whatever. Anyway, sorry for that. That was even worse than the towel story. Anyway, so point is, I was standing in Zichron Moshe, and I have these two bags of Svarim, and I put them, you know, right next to me. And as I was davening Shemoneh Esrei, I was holding them. So after I finished, this Hasidish guy, this Yerushalmi, comes over to me, long white beard, and he says to me, young man, "V'medavent sinishdok hein velt." When you daven, there is no world. You can't hold on to bags. You can't hold on to property. V'medavent sinishdok hein velt. And it like, you know, sometimes somebody says the right sentence and it really hits you in the right way. Mm-hmm. And from that time, it puts you in perspective that when you stand before God, that's what the Rav is saying in this footnote. There's no melech ha'ilam. Mm-hmm. There's no kenvel. There's no bags you don't have to hold on to. Huh? There's no ilam. There's no ilam. Right? So that's what the Rav is saying, that the root of prayer, the fact that prayer is founded upon the covenantal relationship, is responsible for the omission of malchus, God's cosmic kinship or sovereignty, from the 18 benedictions. Then the Rav just says, Baruch, the word melech is there in order to avoid misunderstanding. I wish to add that the phrase melech olam was eliminated from the basic benediction formula, while the term melech does appear in several places. The word melech is there, but not melech olam, because he is your king. Right? That's what the Rav says over here. Okay, let's go back on top. So the Rav is saying, so what's prayer? It's this feeling, there's da kein Welt, there's no world, it's just you standing before God. And therefore, as the Rav said, that what? That prayer should never be reduced to its external technical aspects. Now, here we come to what Lenny has been asking for about 6 months to a year.
Maybe longer.
No, I only know him for about a year, but probably longer.
A little bit longer.
Probably a little bit longer. Now, so the Rav just got through saying that the ultimate prayer is like that simple Jew in the Ribber, the Melech from Lezhensk and Reb Zusha's story, right? The ultimate prayer is that dialogue, the confrontation, where it's just you standing before God. So what's taka with all the words? And the Rav himself said that prayer should not be reduced to its external technical aspects. So the question, which is a resounding question, which Jews have been asking is, so then what's the point of saying, Favaz davin zog in the verta? Why do you have to taka say the words? So the Rav says, to be sure, this awareness has been objectified and crystallized in standardized, definitive texts whose recitation is obligatory. Why? Why is that? Because the total faith commitment tends always to transcend the frontiers of fleeting, amorphous subjectivity. Amorphous means without shape. And to venture into the outside world of the well-formed objective gesture. Let's read that again. The total faith commitment tends always to transcend the frontiers of fleeting amorphous subjectivity and to venture into the outside world of the well-formed objective gesture. Let's read a little more. However, now, no matter how important this tendency on the part of the faith commitment is, and it is of enormous significance in the halacha to say which page and which paragraph, which constantly demands from man that he translate his inner life into external facticity. Halacha does all the time demand that you turn the subjective into the objective external facticity, and that's very important, but it remains unalterably true that the very essence of prayer is the covenantal experience of being together with and talking to God. That's the essence of prayer. Being together and talking to God. And that the concrete performance, such as the recitation of texts, represents the technique of implementation of prayer and not prayer itself. Let's read that again, if you don't mind. Let's read it again.
This is like the famous Reb Chaim on the steer.
He quotes it in the footnote. We're going to get to that. That you see footnote one, where he's quoting right now? Where we're up to right now. Not the prayer itself, footnote one. That's the Reb Chaim. We're going to get to that next week, Mitzvah. I'm not going to have time for that. Now, it's a very long footnote. We'll get to that next week, but I want to go back and focus on what the Rav's saying. Huh? Let's go back. To be sure. Yep. To be sure. This awareness has been objectified and crystallized in standardized definitive texts whose recitation is obligatory. The total faith commitment tends always to transcend the frontiers of fleeting amorphous subjectivity, to leave the frontiers of just not having any particular shape of your subjectivity, and to venture into the outside world of this well-formed objective gesture. You have to translate it into the well-formed objective, strict, concrete gesture. However, let's just read this one more time. However, no matter how important this tendency in the part of faith commitment is, and is of enormous significance in the halacha, which constantly demands from man that he translate his inner life into external facticity, it remains unalterably true that the very essence of prayer is the covenantal experience of being together with God, and that the texts represent the technique of prayer and not prayer itself. Now, what question do you want to ask?
What does that sentence mean? That the total faith commitment...
Yeah. Tends always to transcend...
That sentence, what is that?
Okay, so
what
let's...
are the different pieces? The total faith commitment means which?
I want to read it. Let's go backwards in that sentence, okay? He says that if you're totally... You have a total religious person, you transcend the frontiers of fleeting amorphous subjectivity to the outside world of the well-formed objective gesture. The question I want to ask is why? What the sentence is saying is that the Rav is saying that any truly religious person, by definition, will translate his subjective feelings, which can't be well defined, into an objective gesture, facticity, external facticity, that you could say these are the rules and this is the skeleton and this is the structure. Why is that?
Is that?
In all religions throughout history, there has never been a religion that has not come up with eventually translating into external facticity. I think I told you this anecdote before, and I'll say it again, where I was in a certain place. I don't want to get too specific, because you never know who's listening to what. But I was in a certain place with very progressive, extremely liberal Jews that don't keep any halacha. And they were doing this, rite of Simchas Beis Shoeva, of the libation of water on Sukkot, which in my opinion was a shiloh of a dessert, but whatever. But Lamaisa, they did this whole libation, and this woman rabbi did this whole rite, and like her students do exactly as she said the way to do it, which means they've essentially translated into external facticity. Mm-hmm. So there's never been a religion in history that hasn't eventually translated itself into this rigid set of laws and stuff. Why is that, Taka? And that's the beginning of the sentence. Mm-hmm. Why do you think that is? Why must it be translated into external rigidity? Why?
Because it's easier to repeat that way. It's easier to create a system that way.
Buddhism is...
If you're looking... If you're one of those that say that those that start a religion is in order to create a system to get people to conform, then you're right. But I don't believe that that's the case. I don't believe anyone was trying to create a system to conform.
No, but it's difficult to teach someone how to daven with kavanah, but it's easy to give someone a little mirror. So you say every 10 seconds, look and make sure the thing is there. So they sit there all day long.
Is it right?
I find that very annoying. Now, other
I
people,
find it annoying too. And you that, should,
maybe
I find
I'm
it
a shake. It's
too.
And my thing is, you know, turned around. But it's like, okay, you did the best you could. You put it in the center of your head. Now get on and try and dive. It might be crazy.
Exactly. So here's the thing. So let's leave. Okay, we're opening up a can of worms here. So first of all, let's leave the fact that there are people that become OCD. Everyone knows that there's nothing that feeds into OCD tendencies like Orthodox Judaism. We all know that, right? People, there are a lot of very frum therapists that are making a lot of money because there's nothing like frumkeit that gets a person to be very OCD. Let's put that on the side. That's not what the Rav is talking about. Number two, there's the idea that Yaakov, that Philippe is saying, that there's such a thing as that, the way of looking at it, that you know, the way the scholars, the academics want to distinguish between biblical and rabbinic Judaism, right? The academics want to say there's biblical Judaism where man experienced God, and then the rabbis came along and they wanted to make people conform because of the destruction and the dispersion and the diaspora. And they messed it up, right? They made Judaism into a set of laws, and they just want to make sure everyone conforms because it's much easier to give over to your children a set of laws, right? That's not what the Rav is saying either. The Rav is saying something deeper than that. The Rav is saying there's a reason that the awareness has been standardized into text. Just take it out of the thing.
Yeah, thank you.
There we go. Stella Dora, the Swiss fudge is worth it, but you have to take it. So what's the Rav saying?
Next time, I promise I'll take it out of the floor.
What's the Rav saying? He's not saying OCD, and he's not saying to get people to conform. There's one word that you asked, what's the beginning of the sentence? What's the word the Rav repeats twice? Come on, what's the word the Rav repeats in both these sentences? He repeats twice.
Commitment.
That's the Vart. Mm-hmm. That's what the Rav is saying over here. Commitment.
Yeah,
what's the vart of commitment? What's the difference between a rendezvous and a marriage? A fling in a relationship. Commitment. Commitment is a very loaded idea. Commitment means that it's not based only on my subjective experience. It has to be standardized. There has to be objectivity.
You just made a statement. Why?
Why does commitment have to be standardized? Because that's the definition of commitment. That's the very definition of a commitment.
No.
How else do you express it?
Easily. You don't have to express it.
I wrote, any true believer will end up converting their subjective love into
objective. Who is not really real in a corporate sense. Does not. You do not need to have a set commitment.
God, Jay, let me ask you. Let's go for. Let's talk for a second. Can I ask you a question? You ever go? Here's the question. Okay. So you know those things that I've told you before. When you think a certain way, and then you like, and you say no, but I can't understand how anyone can think otherwise, and then you realize that you were wrong. For many years, it bothered
never
me.
Never happened.
Never happened.
It depends whether I'm saying hi or hi.
Right. So for many years, it bothered me. Why would a person, if you know what a ksuba is, why would you frame it and put it up on your wall? And people spend a lot of money to get beautiful ksubas and put up on their wall, right? And I remember thinking after I learned what a ksuba is, that it must be a maratzim. Only an amaretz, only an ignoramus that doesn't know what a ksuba is will put up on his wall. What's a ksuba? A ksuba is a prenup. Yeah. It's the least romantic. It's the most technical, non-romantic thing that there is, right? It's pushing a technical prenuptial agreement. I'm obligating myself to give you financial, to make sure I provide for you, to make sure... Even sex is stipulated there as an obligation, right? It's in the ksuba as an obligation. It's a technical thing, right? And seemingly it's the most non-romantic thing that there is. It's simply obligation that there is structure of a marriage, and it's very non-romantic. And yet, Shlomo Kalibach taught us, right? And I'm sure when Shlomo Kalibach would have a chuppah, you would read the ksuba and see such beauty there. Because so for many years it bothered me, why would you put up a chuppah on the wall? But the emes is, that Shlomo taught us that a chuppah is the most romantic thing that there is.
Ksuba.
Huh?
Not a chuppah, ksuba.
What? Why would you put a ksuba on the wall, right? It's the most romantic thing that there is. Why? Because there's something extraordinarily romantic about a commitment that's objective. A marriage that has commitment that's objective, right? How long have you been married, Jay? Longer than me, right? Your marriage has lasted how many years?
Kenainar
42. Kenainar, right? We'll celebrate your 50th and your 60th together. But I'm asking you, there's no objective things in your marriage that are not based on moods?
Definitely not objective. If it's based on moods, it's entirely subjective.
Right. So I'm saying, are there no things that make that are necessary for marriage that are objective, that are not based on moods? Don't you need some things in a marriage that are objective?
The institution of marriage is objective.
And some of its obligations.
Because it's an institution.
Right.
It's a politically expedient way to set yourself off from the rest of the world. That's all it is. But there's a huge difference between marriage and how two human beings interact and how a human being interacts with God.
One second, before we get to God for a second, let's stick on marriage for a second.
That's what I'm trying to say.
But in a marriage, the two human beings interact. Doesn't there have to be a structure of an obligation, of commitment?
Two human beings. That is what I'm trying to say. That once one of the entities in that covenantal relationship is not real, and when I'm saying is not real, God is not corporal. He is not a human, he or she or it is not a human being. It cannot be an objective relationship. It has to be subjective. Because what God is to person A is not what it is to person B.
Right, so I'm agreeing 100% with what you're saying. So let's stick to the metaphor of marriage for a second. With what you're saying, every marriage is different, right? Because human beings are different.
Right.
So what marriage is for person A can't be for person B. So why does everyone have the same ksuba? Because the structure, the main structure, what you call the institution of marriage, is objective.
Okay.
That's the commitment. And then you could build on that and make it subjective. Correct? So that's the same thing with what the Rav is saying. There's the commitment to God of halacha, the dry objective commitment of halacha, of the texts of prayer, which is the ksuba. And then you could build on that and make it, and you have to make it subjective and have that interaction with God.
So what I'm saying, okay, I mean, maybe now's not the time to discuss it, but what I'm saying is the framework of halacha is not that covenantal relationship between man and God.
You're right. That's what the Rav is saying. The framework of halacha...
And therefore, halacha is the only objective aspect of the religion, while that covenantal relationship cannot be objectified or institutionalized.
Right, but you need both.
I'm not saying you don't need both.
Right.
The Rav is saying that it has to be objectified.
Also.
And I'm... Okay, so that's what I'm saying.
No, but you also just said that you need both.
Not the relationship. The relationship cannot be objectified.
Agreed. The relationship can't. The covenantal community, the Adam too can't.
Right.
Right. Mm-hmm. But the Rav is saying, so then why do we have texts? For the Adam 1 part, for the halacha part, for the objective part, not for the relationship. That's exactly what the Rav is saying. The Rav is saying the relationship part of prayer is not the texts. So then why do we have texts? Because you also need the Adam 1 basis. You need the objective commitment.
Okay. Let's go on.
I think we're saying the same thing. I don't think we're saying...
Not really, but I understand.
But now you're getting it. Right.
But that goes...
He's saying that commit, but that's the definition of commitment in that sense.
You're using...
The Rav is making a leap that I don't understand. I don't think it's logical, and it just doesn't make sense to me. But that's not for here. Let's learn what the Rav is trying to teach us.
It's organized religion, that's what he's saying. That's what happens. Is this?
I'm saying that division shouldn't exist.
But so again, so the thesis of the Rav is that the commitment is the ksuba. The commitment is the objective rules of the marriage, so to speak, that will then allow the relationship to blossom. So look at Halachic Man, page 57, for a second.
Does anybody in today's world
ever
go back to the ksuba to look at how they're supposed to lead their life with their wives or husbands? No one. It's a certificate of marriage, gets plastered on the wall, but after that, that's the end of it, except if it ends in divorce. Maybe.
Right.
So it's a nice thought, but it doesn't really...
It's obviously a metaphor, so it's not going to be right in all its details, but the idea is because here's the thing. Okay. Because our relationship with God is more ethereal and much more difficult than a relationship between two human beings, we could use that as a metaphor, mm-hmm. but understand that both when it comes to the objective commitment and when it comes to the subjective relationship, both those aspects are going to be more difficult than between a man and a woman. But we could look at the model of the marriage mm-hmm. and see why the same way when it comes to God, you also need both. Am I what I'm saying? Makes sense? Let's see page 57 of Halacha Men. Now there's the truth is that this philosophical idea, which the Rav says very bekitzer and lonely man of faith, and we're going to see in Halachic Men, he says a much more barichos, what there is a Hasidic explanation for why you need these objective words and texts and everything, which we'll leave for next week, Mitzvah Shema, I'll speak about it, but it's a deeper thing than what the Rav is saying. It's a more mystical thing than what the Rav is saying. But here, let's see, in Halachic Men, the Rav elaborates in what he says very much bekitzer over here in Lonely Man of Faith. Page 57, the bottom paragraph. A subjective religiosity cannot endure. Page 57. We all have the same text. 57. Page 57, the bottom paragraph. 57. A subjective religiosity cannot endure. Now, this is not what Yaakov Gershel was saying before, that you can't make other people conform. The Rav is saying that even you yourself, a subjective religiosity cannot endure. And all those tendencies to transform the religious act into pure subjectivity negate all corporeality and all sensation in religious life and admit man into a pure and abstract world where there is neither eating nor drinking, but religious individuals sitting with their crowns on their heads and enjoying their own inner experiences, their own tempestuous, heaven-storming spirits, their own hidden longings and mysterious yearnings, will in the end prove null and void. The Rav is making fun
of yoga.
Of Buddhism.
Yeah. Of Buddhism, of yoga, yeah. Of renewal Judaism.
But there's a problem in that. Buddhism is a billion inheritors.
Okay.
The Rav is wrong.
A billion people can't be wrong.
Right. First of all, if we go by majority, who's right and who's wrong, then Judaism is definitely wrong.
No. I'm not saying that the religion is right or the religion is. The Rav is saying
you're
that
saying
it can't last, but I'm saying it can last.
Oh, so here's the thing, JP. Okay, so I hear what you're saying. So you're saying that Buddhism can last and a billion people do it. Here's the thing. When you say that Buddhism can last, how many Jews do you know, or not just Jews, how many people do you know that have gone on Buddhist retreats and done all these very mystical things, and then come back to regular life and don't stay Buddhist?
Not yet.
The point that I'm saying, though, is that Buddhism, these experiences that people have, that doesn't mean that becomes their whole life. There's no people that, you know, there are some people that will then stay in Tibet and go with the orange robes and stuff. But most people will go and have these experiences in monastery and ashrams, which I'm not refuting that there's some of them are very powerful, extremely powerful. And I'm not saying I'm not closed-minded enough. I know there's some very positive aspects in them. Some people are trying to convince me to try one of them, right? In certain, you know, meditation retreats and stuff. But there's nobody that will that become, that endures to become a way of life. You then go back into your life and you try to remember some, Judaism, what the Rav says, subjective religion cannot endure, he means if it's kihei chayinu v'arach emeinu, if it's a religion that is your oira chayim, your way of life, that its subjective experience can't endure. That's what he means. Buddhism is so successful because it doesn't obligate you to a commitment. The opposite. Why do people love Buddhism? Why are Jews the best customers of all these Buddhist gurus? Because of its experience in God, but without the commitment of changing anything about your life. And the Rav is saying, that's why he's making fun. If it's just sitting with crowns in your head and enjoying your own inner experiences, and it doesn't obligate you to change anything, then you're using God. You're not changing the way of life. You're not changing your way of life for God. You're not having a relationship. That's having a rendezvous with God. That's having a romantic fling with God. That's not changing your life. That's what he means a subjective religion cannot endure.
Well, but can't the same be said for the other way? Can an objective religion endure? I mean, I remember once I was in a shul and, you know, I saw everybody reading the Akdamas and I was like, does anybody?
Nobody knows what they're saying.
I was like, I certainly have. You
but
know,
that's a great
example.
How long
can this last?
So
how many generations
thing.
Can we expect I remember, to read this Aramaic poem that no one in the room knows
right.
what it is?
Right, and Jonathan Kaplan, I remember, he came to me.
Myself
in,
included.
And Jonathan Kaplan came to me in Elul with, I never saw him get angry before, except when he spoke about slichas. You remember? He came and said, slichas, nobody knows what the heck they're talking about, and it's a waste of... And here's the thing. So, but slichas and akdamas, how many years have Jews been saying slichas and akdamas? How many years? much longer than most religions exist.
It's only about 500.
What does that prove, bro?
But again, but the point robots. Is that if a century... No, it's not robots. We're right. committed.
Committed robots.
Right? Again, I'm not negating the necessity of subjectivity. The Rav himself is saying that prayer is more than that. You have to remember,
prayer,
both things are
not
true.
Reading, not sitting there and reading words that nobody understands.
Fine, but only those words are what kept the Jewish people for the 1,800 years since of exile. It wasn't subjective experiences. The things that kept the Jewish people throughout the diaspora was not the meditations.
Agreed.
It was halacha. That's what kept the Jewish people. And I gotta tell you something else. I've spoken to a lot of Reform Jews that say that they know that they could afford to be Reform because the Frum people will guarantee that the Jews will still be if God forbid Mashiach doesn't come in for however long. It's those same people, the robots that we like to make fun of, they're the guarantor that Judaism will continue. Because that's what makes it endure. Whether we like it or not, that's what kept Judaism throughout the centuries. It was those, the objective, how does he say? It'll be proven, those objective facticity. Let's read a little further.
What kept it going also is that the rabbis were innovative.
What?
That they were innovative.
What do you
mean? That they adapted and changed the times. That they wrote down the Gemara when it wasn't supposed to be written down. That's something that
So they also objectified it and concretized, however you say
right.
that.
Concretized
right.
But
it, right?
But that's a little bit, it wasn't like that before. So they continued it. They made it.
So one thing the academics are right. Let's get clear. The transition from biblical to rabbinic Judaism wasn't about the rabbis trying to get people to conform. It was about the rabbis, the Sanhedrin, Yavna, Anshe Knesset Gedolah, whoever you want
to
say. They understood.
That if they didn't write it down.
They understood that because the subjective experience of God, which was so prevalent at the temple, when we actually experienced God, that was departing. If they didn't make the commitment, they didn't put a ksuba on the wall, then the relationship with God would not last. The relationship of marriage could only be if there's the institution of marriage. Because since people change and moods change, if you don't have the commitment of the institution, you can't work on the relationship as much. And therefore, that's why all these things were written down. That's what the Rav is going to say. Tov, let's continue next week, Mitzvah. Bring a lachik man next week. Let's continue because the Rav says some more important things.
The bottom line is saying we should understand Slichas. That's what
he's saying. First of all, Madav the Zog. My grandfather used to, I always say that my grandfather, Zochrein Levracha, my grandfather was a very non-learned person. He was an orphan at the age of 8 and he never went to yeshiva. But he, you know, until 83, he davened 3 times a day. He didn't know, if you would have asked him what Melech Olam is, he wouldn't be able to teach. He didn't know, but he davened 3 times a day. And I remember as a kid, I used to always ask him, you know, Zaidi, why do we have to put on tzitzis? Why do you have to put on film? Why do you have to wear tzitzis? He would always say the same answer. Shteig geschriben. Shteig geschriben. That's, he didn't know, Shteig geschriben. It says it's written. That's what he would say. It says it's written. He didn't, that was his Yiddish guy. Shteig geschriben. And for 83 years, he was a Frum Jew. And there were many millions of Jews that lived without. Shteig geschriben. It says it's written. And that's the base of Judaism. That's why Judaism has survived more than any other religion. Shteig geschriben.
We'll do it.
We'll do it. Nasa v'nishma. Right? Exactly. Nasa v'nishma. Shteig geschriben. The Rav is not saying that we don't need to work on the relationship. That's the whole point in Lonely Man of Faith that he's writing. But again, remember last week we spoke about the difference between Lonely Man of Faith and Halachic Man. And Halachic Man, the Rav is speaking about objectifying halacha. In Lonely Man of Faith, the Rav says a bekitzer, the objectifying, but then his whole point is to work on the prayer. The Rav is not saying that we don't have to work on the relationship aspect of it, but he's saying you need to have those texts to make the shteig geschriben, you have to ksub on the wall to make sure the institution remains.
If a man is satisfied with what he has, does his prayer change very much because he's not asking for anything?
That's a whole nother ballpark of here we're talking about prayer, the petition aspect of prayer the Rav is not getting into. The opposite. He's focusing on the dialectic between the standing before God versus the texts. The mechanics. The mechanics versus the experience of standing before God. Tough.